From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. At about the time John Cleese left Monty Python's Flying Circus, he started group therapy. Several years later, Cleese and his therapist Robin Skinner collaborated on the book Families and How to Survive Them. On today's Fresh Air, Comedy and Depression with Cleese and his therapist. Mickey Katz was the Jewish Spike Jones, parroting the pop hits of the day, but in Yiddish. Coming up, we talk with Don Byron, an African-American clarinetist, reviving the music of Mickey Katz. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by pianist Don Pullen. And TV critic David Bianculli has a lot to talk about, the Emmys, Burt Reynolds' new series, and a new show based on a DC comic book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney today fired the Air Force Chief of Staff for remarks the general made, saying the U.S. would bomb Baghdad and target Saddam Hussein in case of a war with Iraq. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In interviews published over the weekend, General Mike Dugan said that air power was the only effective option to force Iraqi troops from Kuwait. He said that military planners had drawn up plans for a massive airstrike against Baghdad that would target Saddam Hussein, his family, and his mistress. Today, Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said Dugan went too far.
Let me state for the record that Mike Dugan is a fine officer with an outstanding record of service in the United States Air Force and to the nation. Relieving him is not a pleasant task, but I felt it was a necessary one.
Cheney said there are some things the Pentagon never talks about, including the selection of specific targets for potential airstrikes and the targeting of individuals. The White House says President Bush concurred with the decision to dismiss Dugan, the first member of the Joint Chiefs to be fired in more than 40 years. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A meeting of pro-Iraqi Arab countries ended today in Jordan with a pledge to attack U.S. interests around the world if the United States attacks Iraq. The pledge came from 10 Arab countries and the Palestine Liberation Organization at a three-day meeting called the Conference of Popular Arab Forces. The group also decided to challenge the United Nations embargo by chartering a ship that would try to take food and medicine to Iraq. At the close of the meeting, about 1,000 people demonstrated in support of Iraq and denounced Syrian President Hafez al-Assad for sending troops to the multinational force in Saudi Arabia. NASA has scrubbed the planned launch of the space shuttle Columbia following the discovery of another hydrogen leak during fueling. Dave Pignanelli with member station WMFE reports.
A high concentration of fuel has been found once again aboard the shuttle Columbia. The liquid hydrogen was detected in the aft main engine compartment, the same area where fuel was discovered 2 weeks ago. Engineers had replaced a faulty Teflon seal and a recirculation pump package thought to be the culprit. But soon after engineers began loading the volatile fuel aboard Columbia, sensors detected another leak. The fueling has been halted for the night, and the launch has been canceled for a fourth time. Workers will now spend the rest of this evening troubleshooting the area, but it's unlikely an answer will be found soon. This latest delay will almost certainly mean a reshuffling of shuttle flights. Columbia must now make room for the Space Shuttle Discovery, which is currently set for an early October launch date. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Stock prices posted a slight gain today on Wall Street after a day of mixed activity. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 3 points to close at 2,567.33. Declines led advances by a margin of 7-6. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Cleese is known for his work with Monty Python's Flying Circus, Fawlty Towers, The Life of Brian, and A Fish Called Wanda. But when I spoke with Cleese this past June, he had come to Philadelphia to participate in a family therapy conference. He led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner. The two had collaborated on the 1983 book Families and How to Survive Them. Now they're working on a second book. Anyone who's seen Cleese's work would imagine that he's a little eccentric. But it was depression and a failing marriage that brought him to therapist Skinner. For 3 years in the mid-70s, Cleese attended a therapy group co-led by Skinner and his wife Pearl. Robin Skinner is a founder of the Institute of Group Analysis and the Institute of Family Therapy in England. Cleese and Skinner came to our studio, and I asked John Cleese if it was important to him to have a therapist who was attuned to the absurdities in life.
The ideas that I was hearing in that therapy group were extremely different from the ideas that I'd grown up with. I'm talking primarily about the sort of attitudes towards men-women relationships. Terribly different from what I'd grown up with in this tiny little town, in a little seaside town called Weston-super-Mare, population 30,000, you know, very small town. And after a few weeks, I remember quite distinctly thinking, well, this is quite contrary, these kind of attitudes, quite contrary to what I've believed in the past, but I'm going to make a sort of act of faith and go with it for a few weeks. And I think the reason I was able to do that is that there was something about Robin that I instinctively trusted. And that was that he never grasped onto anything very strongly, that he would say something and then almost humorously pull the carpet away from under you just shortly afterwards. And there was something there that appealed to me, and I think it's connected with my sense of humor.
Robin Skinner, was John Cleese funny in the group? and at the beginning, did he try to be funny before he relaxed into the group?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he is very funny. He isn't funny in the way he is in Monty Python. I mean, he's a very amusing companion, very witty. And, of course, some of that came into the group, and other people were amused by it. But in general, he was quite natural.
You will also find, I mean, an enormous number of comics are depressed, I suppose. 80% of the comics that I'm familiar with in England and America, and they're names that would be well recognised by your audience, I think, have a very strong depressive side. And it's a great irony that they spend all their lives cheering other people up. But if you meet them, they tend to be rather quiet people, with a few exceptions. There are some people who are just never off, and they're awfully tiring to be around. I mean, they just do their cabaret act to you for hours if you go out to dinner. But the others tend to be rather quiet and sometimes to have this very slightly mournful quality to them. The manic defense, in other words, is not used by most of them.
Do you think of yourself as that way? And is that something that you've drawn on that you wouldn't in a way be anxious to get rid of? The melancholy.
I think that I was very depressed when I went into Robin's group. And I think that most of the 3 years that I spent in the group was in a sense learning to be sad instead of depressed. I mean, Robin, as we say in the book, I think Robin puts it, that depression is blocked sadness. You can actually relax through the depression into the sadness and feel the sadness that is underneath there, which may be something to do with your childhood, and actually go through that, then you can kind of unload it, right, Robin?
Come out the other side.
Come out the other side. Yes. And I think that I still have occasional moments of depression, but it's not a sort of continual heavy weight on me as it was in the early mid-70s. And indeed, probably most of the time I was making Python. 69 to 73, it was a time when I didn't feel well for about 10 months in the year.
Did that have to do with the work, or was that just personal?
I think it was a combination of the two, and it was necessary for me in 73 to say to the others, look, I don't want to work with the group anymore. I felt that 10 months a year was more than I wanted to work with them. Funny, I've just said I was ill for 10 months in the year. So
you think it was the depression that was part of the reason why you left?
I think it was partly that I was not able to be aware of some of the emotions in my relationship with my wife, and I wasn't therefore able to cope with them, because I wasn't aware of them, wasn't expressing them, wasn't dealing with them. I think that was partly it. And also because I find that working in a group is enormously rewarding some of the time, but I very much need my own space. Mm-hmm. And what was happening in Python is becoming so successful that the others wanted to be doing it 10 months in the year. And I sort of said to them, look, I wanted to make comedy shows with you. I didn't want to be married to you. And then there was a little bad feeling when I told them in 73 that I didn't want to do the next television series. But they had actually, I looked at my diaries the other day, they put an awful lot of pressure on me to do the third series, which I didn't really want to do. And they just didn't listen to my resistance, you know, where they steamrolled me. And I remember Terry Gilliam, he just didn't believe that I wasn't actually keen to go on. They just thought it was me doing some act to get some attention. They just didn't take it seriously. And when I went in the end, a couple of them, mainly Graham Chapman and Terry Jones, were very cross with me for going and talked to me, as I said, about my betraying the group and all this. So I thought it was just a lot of childish nonsense. I mean, the fact was that they were a little bit scared about earning a living outside the group, and the fact that I wanted to go off my own threatened the group. And as I said, I never married them.
You say in the book Families and How to Survive Them that most problems that we have as adults are grounded in our family experience, our early family experience. Let me ask you, John Cleese, about your early family experience. Now, your parents were in your 40s when they had you.
That's right. I was 46 and my mother was 40.
And your father was 46.
My father, yeah. Is that what I said?
You said you were 46.
That's interesting. I was 46, my second daughter was born.
Did you want to analyze what this means?
Many a true word spoken in jest, yes.
Yeah, I was born a little bit with pipe and slippers. I've always been rather middle-aged. That's very funny. Now, I was 46 when my second daughter was born, and I think that that was kind of strange, because it's late for someone to have a child.
So were you the kid whose parents were older than all the other parents?
Absolutely, and had been married for 13 years before I arrived. And everybody was astounded when they suddenly announced they were going to have a child, because they'd been sort of marked down as not going to have children. And I think that the fact that they were old and therefore probably a bit more cautious and a bit more protective affected me. I still wince if anybody turns the television on too loudly in my house, because my mother was always saying, "Don't, you know, it's too noisy, it'll disturb the neighbours." I've got very, very strong sort of lower middle class respectability streak in me, which I hate.
Now, so much of your humour has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman, and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his
Sure that's right. And also, you see, it was nothing surprising about the fact that Fawlty Towers was set in nominally in Torquay, which is just a place exactly like Weston-super-Mare, only a bit bigger, but with exactly the same attitudes. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle-class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie Finis sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off. And they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life, too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. The Murgatuses, their Stavilogus across the bottom, part of Isaac Cruz together, the mids lever the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958. And I've never forgotten it. They got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. Now, your mother was an acrobat? This happens to me all the time.
I'm sorry, I get fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No. So, you know, I always like very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually like one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that?
Oh yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then of course it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And I have two guests with me, Robin Skinner, who's a therapist, and John Cleese, who you know from Monty Python and from all the Python movies, all of his movies, including A Fish Called Wanda. And they've collaborated on a book about therapy. It's called Families and How to Survive Them. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Cleese and Robin Skinner. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
No, yeah, you say your public school education, which, of course, in America would be private school.
That's right. I take your audience on NPR as being so well informed that they would know that.
So this was a school for, like, well-bred,
yeah, middle
upper
class,
middle class?
Yeah, professional, yes.
So you really learned...
I learned how to present myself. In fact, I mean, I was moving up a class by going to a school like that because most of my friends had sort of fathers who were doctors and lawyers and this kind of thing rather than salesmen. But my father had a very okay accent and was kind of interested in the English language, always had a dictionary by his desk, but he'd left school at 15 or 16, and my mother was not particularly well educated, but they had the right accent, they spoke good English, and they had just enough money to send me to one of these public schools as a day boy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life or into a parody of that.
Through writing
and acting.
Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. And if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Timbrook Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
So much of the Monty Python stuff and of your humor outside of Python had to do with seeing the incongruities and absurdities, creating incongruities to show off the daily absurdities of life.
Yeah, pointing them out, really.
Yeah.
Dear old Will Rogers who said, I don't make the jokes, I just point them out?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if he said it, but yeah.
Yeah, I always felt that's what we were doing.
Well, so I'm wondering if you ever... we're interested in Dada or surrealism, you know, if there's like intellectual roots to the kind of incongruities that you were doing, if that just was what you naturally gravitated to.
Never very strong. Yeah. I never particularly resonated to any of their stuff, although there was a cup and saucer in the Museum of Modern Art.
In fur, fur lined? Yeah.
Who was it who did that? Do you remember?
It's a woman. I love that piece.
Yeah, I mean,
I
just occasionally you see something like it, you think that is just terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the whole, no. I mean, I think I led into my type of humor through all the comedy shows I used to listen to. And as I always say, at least 2/3, probably 3/4 of the ones that I really loved in my formative stages were American. It was all Jack Benny. It was George Burns in particular. It was Phil Silvers, who was absolutely fantastic. And then later on, it was Mike Nichols and Elaine May and Jonathan Winters and, you know, incredible richness. And then, of course, the great classics, the Keatons and the Chaplins and the Laurel and Hardys. And you see in there, although, of course, Chaplin and Laurel were English, I mean, they worked in America, there were really only one or two English groups or individual comedians. A guy called Tony Hancock, who was wonderful and isn't known over here at all. And, of course, The Goons, who's, you know, outstanding member was Peter Sellers. But most of the influences were American. But I always loved comedy. If there's something funny happened, I used to write it down in the little book that we were given at school each term. There was something strange going on. It never occurred to me I'd do anything other than become a solicitor.
Now, but you actually have a foot in the corporate world in the sense that you have a production company that does corporate training films, does advertisements for corporations.
Well, no, it's more management and sales training films. We have done a few sponsored or commissioned films for some companies in England, but that's a minority thing. It's basically the films hired by big institutions to train their employees to learn certain skills.
But still, you have to do films that have to be approved of by top executives in large corporations, right?
No, because we make them with our own money. I mean, if somebody like, for example, Volvo came to us to get us to make a couple of commission films 10 years ago, I remember them because I was in them, then, of course, we very much listen to what sort of film they want to make and understand what the information or attitude that they want to put across. But that's sort of 5% of our work. 95% of it is making films with our own money. It's taken a little time to get over the fact that most of our films are humorous, and this puts people back on their heels a bit if they don't understand the difference between being serious, when I believe you can also be very funny, and being solemn. If they're confused about being serious and solemn and think that if you're being funny, you can't be being serious, if they're confused in that way, then they don't like the idea of using our film so much. But we're overcoming that resistance very rapidly. But most of our business is in the East Coast at the moment, and around Chicago, as I say, where the office is.
I actually have a little clip here of one of the training films.
One of the video arts films?
Yeah, and this is one that I assume you wrote, that you star in. And this is like how to not be a repairman.
Oh, yes, the serviceman.
You play a serviceman who's called in to repair a piece of factory equipment. And the person at the factory has said that the machine is making a loud noise. And he's trying to describe it.
What sort of peculiar noise? Oh, well, a sort of scraping.
What, a grating, or a crunching, or a high-pitched squeaking, or a harsh metallic scratching, or a hollow, full-throated humming, or a dry, reedy, sputtering, falsetto squealing, or a plangent, stridulous, crescendoing rasp, or a sibilant, twangy, clamorous, droning countertenor snorting, or...?
It was a sort of harsh, metallic sound.
What, steady, or pulsating, or measured, or intermittent, or seasonal, or cyclical, or rhythmic?
It was pulsating.
Evenly, or...
Evenly.
Staccato?
No, not staccato.
Loud?
Fairly.
So, it was a fairly loud, evenly pulsating, harsh, metallic, glissandoing, scratchy sort of peculiar noise.
Yes.
Right.
That's an excerpt from one of the training films that John Cleese's company does. That's really funny stuff. I'm wondering if you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, we founded the company in 1972, and I'm proud to say that it's now the biggest company of its kind in the world outside the States. We've been making that claim for 10 years, and I'm sure it's right because nobody's ever contested it. And I find that making the films that we do, like, for example, the recent one I made was just on really showing a manager how to coach his subordinates, is not only very interesting, but I actually believe it's enormously worthwhile. I think it helps to move business and therefore society in slightly healthier directions and ways of operating, which very much chime in with the sort of ideas of what is mental health that Robin and I discuss all the time, which incidentally our second book's all about.
I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering, well, how come he's not making films full-time? Why is he devoting so much of his time to this production company that does training films?
Well, I think it's a question of two things. First of all, a feature film is an appallingly heavy commitment. I mean, Wanda certainly took me, I think, 2 years and 2 or 3 months of my life. That's after I've squidged it all together, because it's not all in a continuous line. But so before you take 2 years to write and produce a film, because I hate acting in them, you see, I'm only prepared to do that if I've actually written them. Then it sort of becomes worthwhile to complete the circle and make the whole project done. But if you don't want to take 2 years off to make a film, and you only want to do that occasionally, then it's lovely to be able to do smaller projects here and there. And what I particularly like is any sort of project that's connected with, I suppose, the way people behave or something to do with the human mind, because this is what really interests me. The other thing is, once you've made enough money, and I've now sort of got enough money to coast, you're much more drawn to the things that really interest you than the kind of things you used to do, basically, because you were trying to build your career.
John Cleese is my guest, and also with us is Robin Skinner. And for 3 years, Skinner was Cleese's therapist, and they've actually collaborated on a book together about therapy called Families and How to Survive Them. Robin Skinner, we've been seeing a great example of how incredibly articulate John Cleese is. And I wonder if that kind of ability to really describe things in precise detail is something that works to your advantage or your disadvantage when you're in therapy. And the advantages are obvious because you could explain exactly what it is you're getting at. On the other hand, you could really use that as a smokescreen to kind of amuse your way and talk your way through. I had a friend who was very articulate who said that he'd, that he'd always spend the hour amusing his therapist and walk away thinking, well, managed to get out of that one.
Yes,
you know,
that's absolutely right. And I think it worked to his disadvantage in therapy in that he's so brilliant and his mind is so active that he could process the things he was learning in such a way that they would turn into thoughts rather than... And that would take him away from the experiences from which those thoughts had begun. So when he said earlier that I seem to be trying to pull the carpet out from under him all the time, that's exactly right. That I somehow had to get him to discard or throw away what he'd already understood, so he could have some more fresh experience.
I'd like to get back to acting for a moment, John Cleese.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why? Oh, because you write the stuff, as I imagine, part of it.
Yes, but it's something else. It's something deeper than that. I've got a resistance to it. I think it's because I know actors well, and I know they spend all their time trying to impress people, and I don't like to admit there's a bit of me that does that just as much as any other actor. You know, there's a bit of me that wishes it wasn't like that. I didn't have to impress other people so much. It's funny. It's one of the descriptions of me that always gets my hackles up. It's insane, isn't it?
In A Fish Called Wanda, you made a transformation from repressed barrister to a sexy leading man.
Yes, well, right? Guess who wrote it?
Right. Well, I was wondering if that was your bid in a way to say, listen, I could play this part too. You know, I can be the leading man.
Well, there's so much happened after that film that was vaguely prophesied in the film that I'm not entirely sure how active or inactive my unconscious was, because in fact about 3 months after that film was shot I did actually split up with my second wife, and so you know there's an odd parallel at that time between some of the things in the film and some of the things that are actually happening in my private life.
Do you have any other movies in the works?
No thoughts of them yet. I've got... Well, that's not quite true. I got about 2.5 thoughts, but nothing's going to start getting put on paper, I reckon, until next Easter, because this book we're writing is difficult. I mean, it covers so much stuff. It covers value systems, religions, national cultures, business. I mean, it's just huge. And, of course, you get so interested, and you want to suddenly go off and read 6 books, and there isn't time to. So we want to enjoy writing the book. We refuse to give the publisher a deadline, which is good.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
John Cleese and his therapist, Robin Skinner. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, guitarist Steve Cropper on writing, producing, and performing on some of the great soul hits of the 60s, working with Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, and Wilson Pickett, and on reuniting with Booker T and the MGs. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with one of the more unlikely leaders of the klezmer music revival, African-American clarinetist Don Byron. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Random Thoughts, the new recording by Don Pullen, a pianist who got his start with Charles Mingus. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Flash, an action show based on the DC comic. And Evening Shade, a new series by the producers of Designing Women, starring Burt Reynolds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. For the fourth time since May, NASA has postponed the launch of the Space Shuttle Columbia. A nighttime liftoff was scrubbed when a stubborn fuel leak was detected. At one point, the buildup was more than triple NASA's limit. NASA officials have not announced a new launch date, but earlier in the day, they had said that they hoped to try again early Wednesday if there had to be a postponement. It was during fuel loading May 29th and September 5th that crippling hydrogen leaks appeared, triggering two of Columbia's three launch delays. Egyptian President Mubarak says Iraqi President Saddam Hussein tried to bribe Egypt into silence 2 days before the invasion of Kuwait. The Egyptian leader's comments, carried by the Middle Eastern news agency, were his strongest public statement to date on the Iraqi leader's action. Larry James reports from Cairo.
Mubarak gave no details of the alleged bribery attempt, but local press reports said Saddam Hussein sent a $50 million check to Egypt 2 days before his troops invaded Kuwait. The money is said to have been deposited in Egypt's central bank to be held in case Iraq defaults on payments owed Egyptian workers. Mubarak was speaking to Egyptian troops this morning as they departed for Saudi Arabia. He told the soldiers he did not want war with Iraq, but said if it was necessary, as he put it, to defend the land and all things sacred, then it's God's will. Defense Ministry sources said 250 Egyptian troops left today to join the more than 4,000 Egyptian soldiers already in Saudi Arabia. The source said more men, tanks, armored personnel carriers, and air defense systems would follow, but he did not say how many or when they would leave. For National Public Radio, I'm Larry James in Cairo.
Philippine President Corazon Aquino has called for the pullout of U.S. forces from the Philippines. However, she did not say when that should begin. U.S. officials are expected to propose a 10-year phase-out for U.S. forces. The current treaty covering U.S. facilities in the Philippines ends 1 year from now. Pat Ford has more on the story.
U.S. officials have long maintained that the bases in the Philippines are extremely important to defense strategy for the entire region, but they have recently acknowledged the political realities at work in the Philippines and have let it be known they hope for no more than 10 more years of basing rights. President Aquino is not responding directly to that proposal, but her nationally televised statement indicates that she agrees any new basing agreement must be temporary. The bases are an extremely divisive issue in the Philippines. Most Filipinos support their continued presence for economic reasons, but a large and vocal segment of the population consider the bases an infringement on national sovereignty. For National Public Radio, this is Pat Ford in Manila.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 3 points to close at 2,567.33 on volume of some 111 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli rages against the Emmys. But first, pianist Don Pullen got his big break working with the adventurous jazz bassist Charles Mingus. But he's also played with rhythm and blues and blues acts. Currently, he's featured on two new recordings. On one, he plays organ behind James Brown's alto player, Maceo Parker. On the other, he fronts his own jazz trio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the trio album. Kevin says Pullen has a range to satisfy people who like their music daring or old-fashioned.
Don Pullen has the most flexible right hand of any pianist anywhere. He doesn't just play piano with his fingers. He also shows it the back of his hand. When Pullen developed his style, he was looking for a way to bend notes on the piano, the way a horn player or a blues guitarist does. In fact, you can't bend notes on piano, but Pullen comes close. He whips his hand around 180 degrees and rolls his knuckles up the keyboard. He strikes adjacent notes so fast, they blur together. John Pullen knows some other tricks, too. He can play with conservatory proper curved fingers, or with his fingers flat and splayed out, or with his hand cupped so he can bear down hard on tightly voiced chords. He does whatever it takes to get the sounds he hears in his head. And he moves so quickly between using the front and the back of his hand, you can't always tell where one ends and the other begins. Some pianists who employ alternative techniques use them as the basis for a radical musical language, the perennial avant-gardist Cecil Taylor, for example. But Don Pullen uses his eccentric moves to play more or less traditional jazz. For that reason, he's become the avant-garde pianist for folks who hate the avant-garde. No matter how far out his playing gets, the music keeps swinging. That's especially true on his new album, Random Thoughts, on the Blue Note label. Don Pullen's whirlwind blurs are so striking, it's easy to overemphasize his oddball stuff. He also plays the piano straight. On his solo ballad, Ode to Life, his delicate touch recalls the more classical style of Keith Jarrett. In some ways, Pullen's album Random Thoughts is a remake of last year's disc, New Beginnings. By his own admission, he doesn't enjoy composing, and his melodies tend to fall into a few basic categories: the sensitive solo ballad, the flamenco-oriented number, the bouncing tune reminiscent of Thelonious Monk. But his new album's better than last year's because of the difference in rhythm sections. For the previous record, Pullen used big-name musicians who didn't quite get on his wavelength. On the new album, he uses two talented younger players, bassist James Genus and drummer Lewis Nash. They hook up with him much better. Listen to the way they shadow Pullen on his monk-like composition, 626 Fairfax. Thank you. like that piece a lot because of its sly humor. The tune pinpoints one of the most endearing things about Poland's music, its charm. For all the complexity of his playing, Don Poland knows simplicity has its virtues too. That's how he manages to be both iconoclastic and listener-friendly.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Don Poland's new album, Random Thoughts, on Blue Note. This is Fresh Air. Klezmer music is Jewish pop. It's a hybrid that formed when Yiddish-speaking musicians from Eastern Europe moved to America and picked up on the sounds of jazz and vaudeville. In the past decade, klezmer music has been revived by third-generation Jews. But one of today's freshest klezmer bands is led by a musician who isn't Jewish. He's a black clarinetist named Don Byron. Byron also plays 20th-century classical music and jazz. When he was studying at the New England Conservatory of Music, he became a founding member of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Now he leads his own klezmer band that specializes in the music of Mickey Katz. You can think of Katz as the Jewish Spike Jones, parodying the pop hits of his day, but in Yiddish. Byron not only plays Katz's novelties, he plays the arrangements that gave Katz the reputation as the modernist of klezmer music. One of Byron's recordings is featured on a new anthology called Live at the Knitting Factory, Volume 3. Some of the reactions you've gotten when people have seen you, a black musician, playing klezmer music?
It's different now than it was when I first started playing with the Klezmer Conservatory Band. That was pure shock. When I first started playing with them, I used to wear this big hat, you know, and everybody thought I was wearing this big hat because I was trying to look like a religious Jewish person. I was wearing this hat because I didn't want to see the first 5 minutes of people checking me out and not being able to believe that I was up there. These days, people pretty much, you know, their shock is done while they're reading the paper. You know, they already know who I am, who I'm going to be, what I'm going to look like before they get there, so it's not so bad.
You know, that old question, can white men sing the blues? I was wondering if anybody ever said, oh, can a black person really understand klezmer music? Did you ever get that from anybody?
There's a lot of mental gyrations that people go around seeing black musicians play anything but black music, or even sometimes more than one kind of black music. I mean, if you look at black musicians who play non-black types of music, it's usually the only kind of music they play. And in terms of getting to play that, it's usually a very focused kind of thing. A black classical musician will not usually be maintaining a high profile playing black ethnic, some kind of ethnic music or jazz. So that usually when you see someone like Andre Watts or any of the black opera singers, it's a long time down the road before they start singing spirituals and stuff. In general, It just takes people by surprise that I will focus on a non-black music and then play black music also.
Tell me what you liked and what you didn't like about klezmer music when you started to play it.
Well, I mean, I'm very objective about music, and that's one of my main principles in life, is to be objective about music. You know, I heard some klezmer tunes that I liked and some that I didn't like, and what I liked about them is pretty much the same things that I like about all of the music. There's a certain level of innovation, of avant-garde-ness, of whatever you want to call it, that I look for in music, and I've been able to find in all of the different genres that I've studied or played actively. And I heard that in klezmer, and once I heard that, that's what I wanted to do, was go to that end of the music.
How do you think your approach as a band leader compares with the approach of the Klezmer Conservatory band?
I think the Klezmer Conservatory band was relatively staid compared to the way certainly I conduct myself on stage. And my attitude towards the music is pro-weirdness and pro-fun. Mickey Katz in particular is very pro-weird and very pro-fun.
Tell me why you've been playing so much Mickey Katz lately.
Mickey Katz, to me, was the most advanced klezmer musician in a lot of ways. And I think his talent really got obscured, partially because of the whole comedy aspect, which I guess a lot of musicians who really focus on being funny and being entertaining, like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, a lot of times people tend to miss, you know, what musically is actually coming out. Mickey Katz had the strongest band maybe ever, and the musicians in the band were actually studio-level jazz musicians who were Jewish-American musicians who, even though they had total mastery of jazz or whatever, they still made time to play klezmer music and played it extremely well. And I always, from the first moment that I heard Mickey Katz, I was touched by the level of musicianship, by the level of arranging, by just about everything. And I just don't see that many bands focusing on his music. I just seem like a good idea.
Let me play one of the Mickey Katz pieces that you perform, and this is Kiss of Meyer, and it's a takeoff of the tango Kiss of Fire.
Cigarette, darling? Ma chérie, a glass of seltzer? Oy, when I look on you, it's friend by me a fire. Oy, baby, be mine guest and have a kiss from Meyer. Oy, my heart is burning like a Roman candle. Come to Papier Bubble, I'm your continental. Oy, I'll melt you with a schmutzke and a kuss. Oy, we'll schwitz in some secluded rendezvous. Oy, my darling mademoiselle, don't be late. Oy, don't forget your shade to land your upper plate. Oy, you excite me, I schluck nit to gnaft. I'm feeling...
Who translates the Yiddish for you for the song?
It's really interesting, because I think at this point, after being involved in just Yiddish music for about 10 years, I have about as much Yiddish, not non-speaking Yiddish, as someone whose grandmother maybe spoke, but they never spoke to their grandmother in Yiddish or never really learned. I mean, it's kind of like I know groups of words and I have some vocabulary, but I'm just not especially fluent.
Klezmer music is just part of what you do. You perform with the Mercer Ellington Orchestra, the New England Ragtime Ensemble, David Murray's group, a new group called the Rootless Cosmopolitans. Do you feel like you have a different identity with each band that you play with?
Oh, wow. Well, whenever I play any kind of music, I really, really make an effort to look at and what the sound requirement, what people are asking for, very separately. I don't really bring jazz to klezmer or klezmer to, you know, kind of a punked out rock situation like the Rootless Cosmopolitans. They're all kind of separate disciplines for me.
Now, you studied classical music. Do you play much classical music now?
I pretty much have maintained kind of a low-profile activity in classical music, but, you know, it's more important for me to be involved in kind of new music projects than playing in orchestras, playing Brahms symphonies and stuff.
How did clarinet become your instrument?
Basically, my family kind of has a little pool of instruments floating around that, you know, uncles or cousins or whoever have played and have kind of discarded. And my father played the string instruments. He studied violin and he played bass professionally. And, you know, I could just, if I had to choose between playing the violin and playing the clarinet, of course I was going to play the clarinet because I didn't want my father telling me what to do. I mean, not that that really stopped him or anything, but I just wasn't interested in playing the bass, certainly. And also I had, like, asthma when I was a kid, and playing a wind instrument was, you know, very helpful in terms of improving my breathing.
Was it ever hard to find a place for yourself in jazz as a clarinetist?
There is no place in jazz for a clarinet player. I mean, jazz clarinet does not exist. It just does not exist. I mean, except on a nostalgia level. Except playing swing music. Except playing Dixieland. But, you know, even though I play in contemporary jazz ensembles, I mean, that's just me. That's not jazz clarinet. That's people relating to my sense of line and my sense of how to play jazz the music, but no one gets up in the morning and says, we need a clarinet in our band. People don't do that.
Can I ask what the ethnic makeup of your klezmer band is?
There's two other black musicians. Our trumpet player is Cuban, and I think the rest of the musicians are Jewish American.
Well, Don Byron, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your music.
Okay.
Clarinetist, composer, and band leader Don Byron. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the firing of Air Force Chief Mike Dugan?
The Secretary of Defense has had a news conference and explained his reasons for firing the Air Force Chief of Staff, who told a reporter for the Washington Post that the U.S. target list, should we go to war with Iraq, would include Baghdad in an attempt to kill Saddam Hussein. We also will be hearing from Judge David Souter, who's testifying again. He was asked questions today about the death penalty. Susan Stamberg has a piece on Shanghai Jews, people who fled from Central Europe to Shanghai, and we have an interview with Kitty Dukakis.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The fall TV season starts just as Emmy Awards for the previous year are given. TV critic David Bianculli previews some of this week's new shows, but not until he gets in some words about Sunday night's Emmy program.
I gotta say, before I get started, I'm really chagrined that Twin Peaks and David Lynch got shut out at the Emmys. Twin Peaks should have won for Best Drama Series, Best Writing, and, with Kyle MacLachlan, Best Actor. Instead, it goes 0 for 7 in the major categories. Now, ignoring Twin Peaks is the dumbest thing the Emmy voters have done since, well, since last year, when they snubbed Lonesome Dove and its star, Robert Duvall. For 2 years now, the Emmy Awards have overlooked the very best work done on television. Okay, back to business. One of this week's new series premieres is a show called Evening Shade. It comes from the creators of Designing Women, and it's supposed to be a showcase for Burt Reynolds. He plays Wood Newton, a losing high school football coach in a small town in Arkansas. But even though Reynolds is at the center of Evening Shade and is good, it's the skill and variety of the peripheral characters who make the show so much fun to watch. There's so much talent in Evening Shade that it almost seems overcrowded. At Wood's birthday party, for example, the guests include Hal Holbrook, Ossie Davis, Charles Durning, Mary Lou Henner, Anne Wedgeworth, and Elizabeth Ashley. Even when flanked by Reynolds and Holbrook, it's Ashley who steals the show. She doesn't just have lines. She has soliloquies.
I was deeply hurt. I had to find out about this pregnancy from Imogene Eichert. You know Imogene is like CNN, always bringing the world into your living room. It was just a little funny to me how she said that foreign exchange student from Scandinavia, living there for 3 years, nobody even says a word about it. Well, I mean, it's time to let that boy go home. We ought to all wear T-shirts that say free nails.
Evening Shade is a late entry in the fall sweepstakes, but it's the best new sitcom of the bunch and a rather pleasant surprise. Believe it or not, so is another new CBS series, The Flash. It's based on the DC comic of the same name, it's the most expensive TV hour ever produced, and it's got the toughest time slot on TV, up against The Cosby Show and The Simpsons. The Flash stars John Wesley Shipp as a scientist who has a freak accident. He gets hit by lightning and doused with chemicals at the same time. This gives him super speed, and a fellow scientist, played by Amanda Pays of Max Headroom, helps him measure and control it. Here's a scene where she checks his speed on a treadmill.
Oh my God, are you all right?
Yeah. Liz, I'm really sorry about that. 347 miles an hour?
That was before the equipment crashed. You may not have hit your top speed.
What's happening to me?
What's happening is that CBS has a winner here, but in a loser time slot. The special effects are clever and funny, and kids will love this show, if they ever find it. But if The Flash doesn't make a dent against Bill Cosby and Bart Simpson, CBS ought to move this show to a less competitive time slot, with all deliberate speed.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Vablitis, Dan Lachlan, and Bob Alls. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, guitarist, songwriter, and producer Steve Cropper tells us about his years with Stax Records, working with such performers as Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, and Sam and Dave. And director James Foley talks with us about his new movie, After Dark, My Sweet, starring Jason Patrick, Rachel Ward, and Bruce Dern. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.